Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we examine the status of international action on ozone depletion. Some call this issue the most serious environmental problem humanity has ever faced. Then a conversation with Paul Ehrlich, a research biologist and one of the foremost thinkers on the environment. Ehrlich predicts dire consequences for our abusive relationship with nature. Our ear to the ground will examine one man's effort to mobilize schoolchildren to save money and reduce pollution. And on our Earth calendar, we'll visit the Amazon River Basin, where fish are now swimming in the treetops. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. The universe is a harsh place. Out of all planets, moons, and stars, our Earth is the only one we know of that can support human life. One of the things which makes the Earth livable for us is the shield of the ozone layer. High in the atmosphere, it protects us from radiation from the sun. When a large hole in the ozone layer was discovered over the South Pole a number of years ago, reaction followed a predictable pattern. Some scientists were alarmed. Others, together with industries which produced ozone-depleting gases, belittled the significance of what had been discovered or argued that not enough was known to take any action. Ultimately, nations responded to the preponderance of scientific evidence and agreed on a protocol to phase out the manufacture and use of those gases which damage the ozone layer. Thomas Lally tells us what's happening.
It may seem odd that the gas used to keep your refrigerator cold and the gas once used in some antiperspirant cans eats away the ozone layer, but that appears to be the case. Nearly all scientists today acknowledge that the ozone layer is greatly damaged by certain gases used in a wide variety of industrial applications. A decade ago, goals were set to reduce or eliminate most of these gases. Michael Oppenheimer is a senior scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund. He says the risks of not acting was as high as they get.
Ozone depletion is perhaps the most serious environmental issue that humans have ever faced. And a lot of progress has been made in dealing with the problem, even though it's still there and we're not finished with it.
For years, many industries relied heavily on ozone-depleting gases. Replacing them with other things has not been easy, but efforts have been underway since the landmark Montreal Protocol meetings in 1986 to do just that. John Passacantando is the executive director of Ozone Action. He says although some scientists doubted the ozone depletion theory, today the evidence is overwhelming.
What's actually happening in the stratosphere, where the ozone layer is that protects life on the planet from harmful ultraviolet radiation, has been degrading worse than ever expected in the last several years. On a positive note, the naysayers, those who say it's a hoax, those who are trying to distract us from taking the necessary steps or implementing the steps that had already been taken, are really becoming discredited. Even those in the new Congress, it's starting to look as foolish as it really is.
Evidence of what will happen as the result of a depleted ozone layer are a bit more sketchy. We do know that skin cancer rates will rise. But perhaps the greatest threat is its effect on ecosystems. Already, damage to certain animals and plants has been documented, including damage to phytoplankton, the source of food for many sea creatures. The most abundant ozone-depleting gas is chlorofluorocarbon, or CFC-12. It's what makes most refrigerators cold, so there's a lot of it out there. The Montreal Protocol set limits to phase out CFC-12 and other chlorofluorocarbons, and by and large, those goals are being met. Ronald Prin is a professor of atmospheric chemistry at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's cautiously optimistic when he says things are getting better.
All of the chlorine-containing gases in the atmosphere that are implicated in destruction of ozone, those appear to be reaching maximum levels at the present time. And unless what I'd call renegade manufacturers of the chlorofluorocarbons and these other things like trichloroethane and carbon tetrachloride and various other ozone-depleting gases, unless there are renegade producers in developing countries, for example, that I think we can look at the chlorine-containing gases and with some optimism say that they've plateaued in their levels and should begin a very slow decrease.
But many outstanding problems remain. Although there are today much smaller amounts of ozone-damaging gases being released, a great deal of damage has already been done. Add to that, compounds like CFC-12 have a very long life and will still be depleting the ozone layer 100 years from now. Pasacantando's group, Ozone Action, has also uncovered evidence of a black market in CFCs, both in the U.S. and around the world. Michael Oppenheimer says he agrees with Professor Prin that the situation is better. He adds that more work needs to be done.
I generally share his optimism. The levels of chlorine and bromine-containing compounds will probably be decreasing in the stratosphere over the next few years, and that, as I said, that means the ozone layer will probably start to recover. My hesitation arises from the fact that some classes of chemicals, particularly the HCFCs, which are used to substitute for CFCs in certain uses, are not fully controlled. That also includes a chemical called methyl bromide, which is used as a fumigant, a pesticide in agriculture. If those chemicals, by not fully controlling those chemicals and eliminating them in short order, we are buying into 5, 10, perhaps 15 years of extra exposure to the effects of ozone depletion.
Both methyl bromide and HCFC were the subject of recent talks in Vienna, Austria. Negotiations were rancorous and, for many, disappointing. HCFCs will only start being phased out in 2040, and methyl bromide will start being phased out in the U.S. in 2001. Other countries will begin phasing it out in 2010. Although this timetable doesn't satisfy everyone, many consider it a good start. Humanity's brush with destroying the ozone layer has led many to think about how human activity affects the planet. Michael Oppenheimer says we need to learn from this experience and make sure it doesn't happen again.
The basic message on this whole experience should be that we have to be very careful because small amounts of certain chemicals can have global negative effects, and we ought to really think about what we're doing to the atmosphere before we do it, not get stuck, as we did with the ozone problem, in cleaning up afterwards, in which case unfortunate consequences like increases in skin cancer rates are inevitable.
Although few environmental problems are as severe and immediate as ozone depletion, Professor Prin says action on ozone proves that international cooperation is possible and that alternatives to environmentally damaging practices and substances can prove viable.
It was a remarkable international agreement among the various countries of the world to phase out these compounds. In itself, even the policy part of this whole issue was a unique step toward handling global environmental problems. So I think all aspects, the policy issues, the industrial manufacturing issues, the policy issues, and the environmental research issues, are all, we've learned a lot of lessons.
By all accounts, a great deal of work is still left. Many of the compounds already addressed are some of the easiest to find alternatives for. Those involved say the challenge is to keep up the momentum now that light has appeared at the end of the tunnel. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
We're always interested in what you have to say. You can write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Or you can reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or you can try our new homepage on the World Wide Web. If you have any doubts about the fact that we are the Environment Show, our webpage is green. You can find us at www.wamc.org/env. And if you have as much trouble as I do figuring these things out, here it is again. www.wamc.org/env. I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, our ear to the ground, Linda Anderson, speaks with one man about his campaign against inefficiency. School children have taken up his cause. They cut school energy costs and make money for environmental projects. And our Earth calendar will take us to the Amazon River Basin. Fish there are now swimming in the treetops. These stories still ahead on the Environment Show. One of the giants in the field of conservation biology, who has shaped a lot of our thinking, is Dr. Paul Ehrlich, Bing Professor of Population Studies in the Department of Biological Sciences at Stanford University in California. His book, The Population Bomb, focused attention on the impact an increasing world population is having on our resources. The relationship between population and the environment was explained by Paul Ehrlich long before the concept of sustainability became current. He was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship in 1990 and the United Nations Sasakawa Environment Prize in 1994. I caught up with him just after he'd returned from Australia, where he's doing research on evolutionary trends in plants and animals as they cope with disturbance of their habitat. He talks about what he sees ahead.
Well, if current trends continue, I see our grandchildren living in a world that is much less satisfactory than from the point of view of human existence than the one today. In my view and that of a lot of other people, the quality of life has declined rather dramatically over the last 30 years, even while gross national product has increased. We are about to enter into what physicians have described as the post-antibiotic era. I can remember the pre-antibiotic era when I got an ear infection. A doctor came and lanced my ear, which was a very painful thing, thanks to our bad treatment of the epidemiological environment, our gigantic population size, we're going to be much more vulnerable to disease and much less able to deal with it. It looks, there's every sign that food is going to be more expensive for almost everybody and maybe unavailable for large numbers of people. That much will depend there on what luck organizations like the International Rice Research Institute has in trying to solve the problems of increasing agricultural production, which has now been falling behind population growth, and also on what's going to happen with global warming and the ozone layer and general toxification of the planet and so on. But the future to, I think, all sensible environmental sciences looks decidedly grim, and the big hope is that we will actually manage to change our course. But, of course, the United States, there's a very active backlash movement trying to turn the clock back and basically sell out our children's environment for fun and profit today.
Given the research that you've been engaged in, do you see that the kind of flora and fauna that our grandchildren will find common to be quite different from what we're used to today?
Well, I think that that at the very least, there will be many fewer different kinds of plants and animals around in 30 or 40 years. That's almost a given. In other words, many, I believe, and many of my colleagues believe, of the plants and animals that exist today are essentially the living dead, that their habitats are now too small and too highly altered to support them in the long run. So I think that the opportunities certainly to enjoy relatively undisturbed nature that are available to people today are going to be very much reduced, both by the reduction of the amount of relatively unspoiled nature, which will be dramatic over the next 20 or 30 years unless big changes are made, and of course also because there could be as many as 50% more people trying to enjoy that unspoiled nature.
Over the last decade, the language and the thinking of people who are concerned about the environment has really changed substantially. We now talk about waste elimination rather than simply reducing things at the source. Conservation biologists such as yourself have really introduced a whole new way of thinking about an ecosystem that doesn't focus exclusively on individual species. What will the conservation biologist, the forward-looking environmentalist, what kinds of terms, what kinds of points of reference will they be using 25 years from now?
Well, if conservation biology persists to that point, and I think that's a question, it's a question of whether society as we know it will persist to that point, I think the focus will be on restoration. That is, it's starting to shift in that direction already. We've already vastly overshot the carrying capacity of the planet. In the process, we are destroying our natural capital, including our living capital, at a very, very rapid rate. And more scientists are beginning to think about how one might restore it. I have a postdoc in our lab now who's working very hard on the difficult issue of can you restore tropical forests in working in Costa Rica on that. At the moment, of course, there's no real market for that except to a small degree in surface mining restoration and so on. But the basic answer is that if we ever do manage to get the expansion of the human enterprise under control, then we're going to have to try and restore and rebuild our natural capital, and that's going to be a technically extremely difficult job, particularly in a world which inevitably will be vastly more overpopulated when we start than it is today. And so that's where the focus of the discipline is will clearly shift, again, but that assumes the persistence of research universities and of disciplines like conservation biology. And I think none of that is certain, because as the environmental supports of civilization begin to give way, the social contract may start to give way as well.
Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, destination conservation. When a strip mine was built next to his farm in Edmonton, Alberta, Brian Stasinski told himself, never again in Alberta will another coal-fired power plant be built. Already involved with environmental issues, he decided to work with schools and began Destination Conservation, or DC. DC is a program designed to improve energy use, water use, and waste management practices in schools. Stasinski says it's a student-driven, activity-based program that serves to increase personal awareness and encourages participation by all members of the school community.
We work with the students, the parents, the teachers, the custodians, the principals, and we train them how to do lifestyle audits on their consumption practices in areas of energy, water, and waste. And they find the goodies and the baddies, the good things that are happening, the bad things that are happening. And then they come up with solutions for the bad things. Like, for instance, principals may leave their lights on in their office when they leave. Well, the students will go and catch those principals and remind them to turn their lights off.
In addition to these lifestyle audits, Stasinski says there are technical audits done on the school facilities. From all the gathered information, students implement conservation campaigns in their schools.
When we do the retrofits and we combine it with the lifestyle practices, we reduce consumption by an average of 30% for each school, and we get them to understand what that means in terms of dollars and in terms of avoided emissions. Like, they actually get to understand how much CO2 doesn't go up into the atmosphere as a result of their efforts.
Stasinski says the results are successful. Not only are schools reducing their negative impact on the environment, but the program helps pay the bills. Overall utility reductions, he says, have saved Alberta schools over $1.5 million. 10% of those savings go directly to the students, who spend it on things like improving their school's recycling system. DC is growing, and this, claims Stasinski, is because it works. The program goes international this year, with projects planned in Mexico, New Zealand, and the United States. There's no problem motivating the students, according to Stasinski, especially the kids in grades 4 through 7. He finds they're already concerned about the environment and anxious to do something about it. When they see the actual impact they have had on the environment, Stasinski says they get inspired to tackle other issues.
They start on energy, and they start on water, and they start on waste, but they soon move to other issues like protecting whales and rainforests, etc., and they go on and work on other things. And what they do is they learn that they can have an impact, and I think that's the exciting thing about the program.
With Ear to the Ground, this is Linda Anderson.
In this week's Earth Calendar, we return to the Amazon Basin, where the Amazon Center for Environmental Education and Research is located. The center is 2,300 miles upstream from the mouth of the river and is in Peru, But even there, the Amazon is a mighty forest, being 2 miles wide. Water levels fluctuate tremendously, more than 50 feet in some places. They started rising in November and are now on their way to their peak in April. As the waters come up, vast amounts of the tropical rainforest are submerged, and fish swim among the trees, eating fruit and scattering seeds, in much the way birds and squirrels do in drier locales. Roger Mustalish, president of the center, describes the scene.
Another thing that's down there are these freshwater dolphin. They have two major species, gray and pink. They normally like shallow waters in the main part of the channels. But when the floods take place, these dolphin will migrate in, and they too can be found swimming amongst the trees. 6 months earlier, these would have been trails that you could walk on, and you would be hundreds of yards from the river. But during the flood zone, you might be in 20, 30 feet of water with these freshwater dolphins swimming amongst the trees. Unfortunately, when the floodwaters drop, some of these dolphins get actually stuck in the branches and in the crotches of trees, and they die. And so a lot of the local people will then go and take them out and use them for food or just dispose of them. But it's a very eerie sight to be walking down a trail during the low water and look 20, 25, 30 feet up into a tree and see the carcass of a freshwater dolphin that had been trapped there during the previous flood season. Another thing that's really important for a lot of the trees down there is the fact that there are a number of different fish species that feed on fruit. And so during the flooding time, these fish will migrate into the forest and feed on the fruit. And as they're swimming around, they disperse through their metabolism the seeds of this tree. And so there are a number of plants in the rainforest that normally are very far distances from the riverways, but they exist specifically because of this fish coming during the flood season, eating the fruit, and then dispersing the seeds so that the tree can survive.
There are more than fish and trees in the Amazon rainforest. Humans are there, too. Some are destroying it, and others have lived there for centuries and have an understanding that awed Dr. Mustalish.
You know, there have been some estimates, for example, that within the next 30 years, the neotropical rainforest of the Amazon basin will essentially cease to exist, and that there will be islands, there will be pockets of these mature trees with remnants of the biodiversity, but the huge expanses of rainforest that you can see now if you go to Peru or if you go to parts of Brazil and Venezuela and Colombia and Ecuador will be gone forever. And I went down there, I have to admit, with a certain sense of cynicism on my first trip, thinking I should see it before it was destroyed, and I came away saying that we have to do whatever we have to protect it and simply not accept deforestation as a reality. One of the things that I've come to appreciate in my travels there has been the extreme amount of intimate knowledge that the indigenous people have with their environment. An intimacy and a level of knowledge that we in our country have lost for the most part. And the use of medicinal plants or the use of different fibers and leaves and barks and stuff for everything from clothing to shelter is unbelievable. And we really are the primitive people when it comes to having that intimacy with the environment.
The interdependence of all forms of life has almost become a cliche among people concerned about the environment. But how many of you knew that as we speak, the waters are rising in the Peruvian Amazon and fish are planting trees? Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 312. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, and Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.